Welcome to this first university colloquium of the spring semester. We're very happy to welcome Simon Bronner as today's speaker. Dr. Bronner is the Distinguished University Professor of American Studies and Folklore at Penn State Harrisburg, and he's currently the chair of the American Studies program there. He's the author of quite a few books and articles, and if I read you all the titles, he wouldn't have any time to talk, so trust me on that. But he's written on a variety of topics on folk culture, and I would mention that his work on the Amish has been particularly noted. He received the Pennsylvania German Society's Award of Merit for his studies of the Amish and the Pennsylvania Dutch. I'm looking forward to today's talk, where he's going to be talking about comparisons between the Amish and the Hasidim as a folk culture. Mark Sawin is responsible for hooking us up with Dr. Bronner, so thank you, Mark. Mark describes Dr. Bronner as the godfather of the Eastern American Studies Association. Did I get the name right? Yes, Eastern American Studies Association. He was president of that association for a while and hosted the annual meetings for a number of years, and has helped to really enliven and facilitate a lively American studies conversation in the Eastern U.S. If Dr. Bronner's the godfather, perhaps Mark is the godson, because Mark is also a former president of the Eastern Association, and this year is serving on their executive board and is organizing their annual conference, which we're which we're lucky enough to be hosting here at EMU on March 22nd and 23rd. This conference will be bringing top scholars from prestigious Research One universities from all up and down the Eastern Seaboard, presenting papers in the field of American studies. And among those prestigious scholars will be five presentations by our own EMU faculty and students. So I'm very proud of the part that we've been able to play in this association, and particularly the work that Mark has done. If you're interested in attending some of those sessions and finding out more about what this field of American studies is all about, I'm sure Mark would be happy to talk with you and give you details about how to join those sessions. I understand that at least one day is going to be open to the public. Is that right? Yeah. So keep that in mind, and without further ado, I'm happy to invite Simon Bronner to the podium.
Thank you very much for having me. Thank you very much for coming out at this hour. I hope your stomachs aren't grounding too much, and I hope to give you some things to think about, and I look forward to the conversation afterwards of this work that I am working on. In case you're not familiar with the term from, it is Yiddish for religious, something of an equivalent to plain, but it has the connotation of more than religious, but being involved in a tradition-centered group. As a prologue, I might say that moments of encounter between these two tradition-centered groups, the Hasidim and the Amish, have been relatively rare in both folk culture and popular culture. In fact, when it has been a moment of encounter in popular culture, it's usually to point out that it's mistaken. Some of you may remember the movie Witness, where the boy comes into the Philadelphia train station and encounters a Hasidic man thinking that he was Amish, and then backs away with great surprise and consternation. This is another one that you may not know as well. It is a comedy. I have to admit that I picked it up when I was in Israel, so you will see a subtitle in Hebrew and Arabic, in case those of you who are interested there, you will hear Yiddish and Pennsylvania Dutch, and basically the conversation is about whether the language that is spoken is similar. Another encounter that shows, at least to an American public, that this encounter, while appearing similar, is somehow mistaken or out of place. My countrymen. I was in San Francisco and got beaten up. What's the matter? Can't you speak Yiddish? And much of this mistakenness is supposedly based upon religious difference rather than the issue of tradition. The moments of encounter in folk culture are also rare, but I might say one of the areas that I have been working on is in Lancaster County, which hosts the Lancaster County Yeshiva, which is the only yeshiva in the United States, I'm trying to figure out if it's in the world yet, that gives training in trades. However, because it's in Lancaster County and the number of Orthodox is relatively low, they require Amish to help train the yeshiva students in these building trades. And this has led to something of a fortification, if you will, of dress and particularly head covering among the women because of the notion that head covering, such as the Jewish snood, or something called a taicho, which is a scarf which is worn around the head as well, and even the wearing of wigs, is comparable to the bonnet, and they're constantly asked, what Mennonite sect are you part of? Here is a little interview. I am not the interviewer, because you're going to hear reference to the Amish. It is actually in the school. This is a Hasidic man wearing a Amish hat that he picked up from one of the fellow workers, and he comments on this encounter. Payas or side locks?
Yeah, that's the language is similar.
Simplicity. And that is a question certainly to be taken up in talking about comparative study of some of these groups. One of the barriers to a comparative study is, in fact, what to call them. There was an influential book that some of you undoubtedly are familiar with called Extraordinary Groups that tried to get away from the idea of some of these groups as sects or cults or some of these loaded terms and give the idea that they were separatist in their own way, therefore they were extraordinary. However, in some of the major works, either in Amish studies or Hasidic studies, which I try to work in both, I was surprised that, for example, the Hasidim were left totally out of the classic work, Amish Society, despite this notion of the Amish, which John Hostetler, who some of you may know, introduced as a folk society. The Amish, on the other hand, were totally left out of studies of the Hasidim, such as the world of Hasidism and Jerome Mintz's Legends of the Hasidim and later Hasidic people. Well, why not compare them? Doesn't it seem obvious, especially with these moments of encounter that you've seen in both folk and popular culture? I think part of the answer is the response of religious and ethnic studies to the problem of these tradition-centered groups in America. Part of that is that the study of the Amish, particularly in religious studies, was related to studies of the Reformation and Protestantism with the idea that Mennonites, Anabaptists, and Pietists were a special problem within that historical issue. And then within that realm, there was enough to study just with understanding all the schisms and subgroups that occurred as a result of those schisms. So that the questions were often of persistence and unity within these radical pietistic traditions. And yet this was differentiated from communal studies, which seemed to be an exception to the Amish and other Anabaptist groups who were communitarian. It was also outside of ethnic studies because of the notion of ethnic studies, especially concerning the issues of race and class. Hasidism was related to Jewish studies that was very concerned sociologically about the existence of these urban villagers, because sociologically you can accept, or many sociologists accepted, the notion that rural life allowed for a kind of isolationism. And this was also true with Appalachia or the Cajuns, which are also studied in this way. What do you do with the Hasidim? For a long time, what you did is you ignored them as an exception, or it was part of Jewish studies because of this idea of a charismatic movement, particularly related historically to what was going on in Eastern Europe before and after the Holocaust, also outside of communal and ethnic studies. Well, is there potential? There have been some who've suggested it, but not explored it. Solomon Pohl suggests that there are similarities to other religious minority groups, especially about the issue of adaptation, raising this question about how these villagers who existed in what were called shtetlin in Eastern Europe could adapt to places like New York City, the largest city in the United States. Or Don Yoder, who some of you may have known, who did talk about the comparison along the lines of sectarianism, a term that some have disputed, yet he noted that both the Hasidim and the Amish have this common link to European peasantry. And part of what he was interested in is how, in fact, this became codified in the United States for both groups, that there seems to have been an evolution in Europe itself When it came to America, it actually became more conservative in his thesis. So why compare, just quickly, sociologically in this interdisciplinary work? I think it tests assumptions about the value of tradition within a modernizing society. Culturally, there is a question, as you've seen in some of these clips, about the symbolic significance of language and dress, particularly in an individualistic society. And with this, there is the relationship, what some may call a kind of double consciousness, to borrow from Du Bois's term, about a group that is also a subject of gaze, so that it defines itself also by what it is not, through mass mediation, such as shows such as Amish in the City, and you see a Hasidic reggae rapper really testing boundaries, and the issue of language and food and transportation as representing some kind of ancestry that general Americans want to tap into, even though they're not genealogically related. And historically, what is the relationship to Europe, which is a classic American studies question, and particularly because the assumption of assimilation and acculturation is challenged by the continued, not only existence, but also growth of both of these groups. They were predicted to be doomed in the 1960s in relation to modernization, and in fact, both have tripled their size since that time and spread geographically as well. Well, we can talk about differences that have made this comparison difficult. Jewish, Christian, rural, urban, the Amish based upon an early American migration, Hasidim really came after World War II. They transplanted as a result of the Holocaust. They did not want to reestablish themselves in Eastern Europe, particularly with the Soviet Empire. Amish have roots in Central Europe. The Hasidim have roots in Eastern Europe, but also related to the Palatinate, at least genealogically because of language. And the Amish are an object of American tourism. The Hasidim are not. But here are some of the similarities that are worthy of analysis to talk about what is the role, generally, of tradition within a modernizing society. Both are tradition and pietistic groups. And one could argue that both are pacifist in their own way, which causes quite a bit of issue, particularly in Israel, because the Hasidim are exempted from war service. They are resistant to the world. That doesn't mean that they do not have technology, but they resist it or want to tame it, and especially because of the view that technology represents a world of temptation and potentially of evil. They are communitarian, both communitarian, not communal, and they both have a history of dissent and persecution, and they use distinct language, dress, and food, and even transportation, one can argue. I'll try to get into that a little bit, but they use these cultural expressions differently. Some of the historical question, of course, is the relationship to homelands, and something that has developed is that there is a reverse tourism of a lot of Hasidim to Eastern Europe to visit graves of the what they would call versions of Saint Tzadikim in Eastern Europe, and there is this sense of it being a homeland. In many ways, Pennsylvania and New York have become the new homelands of some of these groups, so much so that one of the movements, especially by the Lubavitch Hasidim, is to recreate this one house where their charismatic leader, the Rabbi Schneerson, lived, 770 Eastern Parkway. And so they have a global movement to reproduce this house all over the world. And it really is something to see, this little Brooklyn brownstone, or at least the structure of it in places like Sao Paulo and in Tokyo and other locations. There's also the question about the relationship to each other linguistically, some of you involved in language, and there is a theory about Yiddish deriving from the Palatinate and whether some of the terms are in fact similar and borrow not just from German but in fact from Plattdeutsch of the Palatinate area and what they have in common. Whereas a lot of the Amish relationship is to its enculturation, particularly with groups of the English and Scots-Irish and even Welsh in the Pennsylvania experience, where the Hasidim often argue about the Polish and Russian debt. Okay, sociological propositions, and your provost is welcome to stand up if I miss any of these or misconstrue these. They are organized differently, yet they each have a similar problem. The Hasidim are organized by courts that relate to charismatic rabbis in Eastern Europe of a place. My father, for example, grew up in a place called Ashvenshim, which was oriented to the Bubavir, which are still exist. And some of you may have heard of the Satmar, Lubavitch. This generally relates to places in Eastern Europe, these kinds of names. The reason why the Amish and the Hasidim have a similar sociological problem is that they are based upon uniformity in these small groups, which at the same time enables a tradition-centered experience. It also has the risk of schism, that if someone doesn't agree, if they are not all of the same mind, what do? They take off and form their own court. And this is also been certainly a problem with the Amish as well. Mark was telling me about a poster in his office that he keeps of 250 Mennonite groups and trying to keep them straight, although it needs to be updated annually. A question is location. The Amish, as you well know, have a value system upon the idea of the value of not only of hard work, but particular relationship to the earth and to agriculture. The Hasidim were not urban dwellers in Eastern Europe, but they have adapted, and there are some paradoxical situations. So, for example, one of the industries that they're in is very heavily in retail, but they sell TVs and cameras and movies that they themselves do not watch or own. And this is the kind of paradox that exists in this non-agrarian occupational base. Well, what about the issue of social change, another very important sociological proposition, because from modernistic eyes, they both seem to be taming not only technology, but change. And there has been here a proposition by Solomon Paul that the Hasidim have been more successful at adapting than the Amish have. And that is because of his notion that their response to technology has been to make these objects religious rather than treating them as part of the evil world. And soon, if you're welcome to come to our neck of the woods, Elizabethtown College, there's in fact a conference on technology and the Amish coming up in June that I'm sure is going to be taking this up, and I'll give you some other examples. For example, instead of rejecting the cell phone, the notion among the Hasidim is that you kosher it. So you can pre-program it so as not to ring on Saturday, but therefore you can embrace it. And there's a whole book about the role of the telephone in Amish society and why this has caused such a conflict, whether to put it away from the house, what to allow, and so forth. And Paul claims these kinds of arguments do not exist. So this is an area that exists. Culturally, there's an issue about segregation by uniformity of dress and what becomes more important. The Hasidim do drive and don't see transportation as cultural expressiveness, but they do with hair and with food because of the notion of koshering, which the Amish generally have not done. Well, both then are subject to modernization theory because they are communitarian groups. And again, to the tourists, they often expect that both Amish and Hasidim should not make money. That by being tradition-centered, it means they reject capitalism. And increasingly, the argument is that they are, in fact, modern groups in the sense that they use capitalism to drive modernization. And the question then becomes, what are their strategies for taming it if they nonetheless accept that by joining capitalism, they will be subject to the pressure to progress and to take on novelty. So plainness and stiffness and order among the Amish and the Hasidim are both seen as responses to crisis by maintaining control. And this is part of the theory of why there has been a movement toward conservatism in the United States where there was not in Eastern Europe. Don Yoder's folk community explanation, if you're not familiar with that, is that the codification of plain costume especially was not just a signal to other people of difference, but within the group, that it allowed for a submission to the community, a reverse of what may seem intuitive. And psychologically, although this has not been as much of the scholarship, and this is an area I'm trying to explore, is what is represented psychologically about the rhetoric of plain and from, because it's more than saying you're part of this category or you're part of that category. Among the groups themselves, these are loaded terms that are a form, I would say, of enforcement by indicating what the boundaries are of fromness or of plainness. And there's more that can be said for that. The other part of American studies, since that was introduced, is to talk about what the popular culture influences are and how these groups deal with that, because they are separatists but not apart. And this issue of massification in American studies comes into play because of the assumption that while modernization and capitalist influence should promote individualism, there is a counter notion that it also means uniformity. And you've heard and will hear this idea that this means complexity, and it also means that one cannot be different. So part of the tourist gaze is, how is it that these people are able to be different? And one of the ideas that I give credit to John Hostetler and in discussions before he died, he was very influential, especially this was one of his later ideas, that if we didn't have the Amish and Hasidim, we would need to invent them. Because of this notion that for people of faith who have gotten away from these roots that they recognize as part of their heritage, they want that group to persist so that they can feel that it still has a place in the world that they can relate to. So they use these groups symbolically. And he applied it to the Amish. I tried to use it for the Hasidim. And I see more and more examples within especially popular culture, if it is possible to generalize about some of the shows that are now bringing out the Amish. They're often placing Amish in temptation, such as Breaking Amish, which places these Amish youth, especially in New York City, and there's one coming out called Shunned, interesting term, of ex-Hasidim who are dealing with temptations of modern life. And these shows emphasize youth because of this idea that modern society is youth-oriented rather than the traditional view of handing down wisdom from old age to youth. There are also ways of checking commitment, as if by being apart there is something disingenuous about this kind of an existence. And one may say this is exploitative, and I'll be glad to get your comments, but also culturally there's this idea that a lot of these shows, while they seem to be about the Amish, may be more about modern culture in the sense of a worry about authenticity in modern culture. And so saying, if I've fallen for this system, shouldn't they? How do they do it? How do they resist? And that seems to be the sub-theme. A problem that has arisen with this kind of mediation is what I call a tendency toward binarism. And that is that it's an either-or proposition. Either you're modern or you're traditional. And I think this audience probably knows better than most that that leaves out a whole range in between. But those nuances tend not to be covered in these kinds of cultural mediation. This is true for the Hasidim as well, because there's something called the modern Orthodox, as well as the traditional Orthodox and conservative in Judaism. And certainly we were talking, Mark and I were talking about the Wenger Mennonites. I edited a book a student did on the Old Order River Brethren, these kinds of groups in between that accept certain forms of modernization that tend not to get into the picture, I think, because of some of this concern. So how do these groups relate to each other, especially as a carryover from some of these reality groups? Not very well. This is a spoof that appeared on YouTube, which is a parody of cop shows. I'd like to show you more, but in the interest of time, what I can summarize is that in this spoof, it's saying how ridiculous this is, or pointing attention to a lot of the representation of tradition-centered groups either are totally absent or are relegated to the idea of authority, that the cop shows show that there is an issue of violence in the world, which tends to be regulated by these police, not socially or culturally. The other trajectory that has occurred through this mediation is this idea of the Amish representing tradition, whereas it used to be how the Amish relate to the outside world. Some of the shows and the discussions now are about groups coming back to tradition, especially as the Amish have gained so much more notoriety. Here's one that some of you may know called Living with the Amish, which brings youth again, this emphasis on youth and what kind of traditions they inherit, and brings them to Pennsylvania to experience Amish life, to see if they can hack it.
You may think us Amish are strange and old-fashioned folk, but with our buggies, beards, and barn raisings. But to tell you the truth, we feel pretty blessed with the richness of our lives.
Wow.
Last year, five of our Amish teenagers were invited to experience life in Great Britain.
Now, that's the conventional approach.
And welcome some young English folk to come share in the pleasures of our Amish life.
Good morning, guys.
My name's Jonathan, and my wife Marietta and I feel most privileged to be the first to play host to the Young British Poet. Over the next 5 weeks, they'll stay with several different brethren, from Pennsylvania to Ohio, to get a true taste of just how us plain folk live. I just know we're all in for a treat.
But this is the part I want you to pay attention to, of how the choices they make among the youth are saying modern society is too complicated.
Home to 14,000 Amish folk and our hometown. My name's Jonathan Hertford, and I enjoy working in the local timber trade. While my wife, Marietta, well, her job is to tend to the house, and she just loves that. It's a quiet life, but it's all going to change when six strange English youths arrive at our door in just a few days' time. I don't like to think about it beforehand, what they might be like, because obviously they're from a whole different country. You really don't know what to expect. All we do know is that these teenagers have been handpicked to represent the best of British youth.
So here's their representation of youth culture.
I want to live with the Amish because I know that they're quite minimalistic and they, you know, they don't have electricity, they don't have a lot of things that I take for granted every day. And I want to know that, one, what am I, can I survive like that? And then two, you know, do I like surviving like that?
Oh, you could do a thing I like a little bit. Going to live with the Amish hopefully is going to help me build my confidence. I don't have anything in common, really. I suppose my life is nothing like theirs, but I'd like to be able to have that simplified lifestyle, because I think life sometimes is so complicated with all the media and pressure of looking good and stuff. I don't like that.
All right. Now, getting back to the insider's view, if that's the outsider's view, while these groups have grown largely because of high birth rates, there is definitely tension. One is the relationship to other Anabaptist groups on the case of the Amish, and on the other hand, the Hasidim to one another and the different courts and some of the competition over some key issues. Such as the relationship to Israel, for example, and whether to proselytize or not. The Hasidim generally do not. The Lubavitchers do, but not for converts, but for what they consider non-Jewish Jews, to bring them back to Judaism. Suburbanization and new development, some of the same success that has caused Lancaster County to boom has also forced many Amish away from their farms into some new settlements that again creates new encounters. And one of the areas that I would predict where you're going to see more probably alliances is in New York State, upstate New York, which is considered a great growth area in terms of the Amish, and also Hasidim moving out of New York City because of the expenses in creating new settlements there. They're also related to school districts as well, because they're trying to create homogeneous school districts. Occupation, economic issues, half of Hasidim are under the poverty line. They do not go to higher education. Another problem is caused because of the traditional male role is to study. That needs to be subsidized, so women become the primary breadwinners, and also among the Amish, there is a shift of the economy more and more to the women to provide for the family as agriculture becomes more difficult. And also the response to rapid technological change. There are Amish websites and so forth. Well, what do we make of all this, or at least what I can suggest are some theses that may help us either to test what is going on currently, or to perhaps anticipate what the future role of tradition in modern society might be. One is that I would say sociologically, we'll see those of you who are sociologists agree with this, is to revise the folk society model. It is not apparently applicable, particularly to the kinds of encounters and interchange that is occurring today. That is not to say the tradition is not holding. It is, but there seems to be more pressure. And part of what is occurring, ironically, is that some of the cohesion is occurring as a result of the tourist gaze or of the pressure to provide for these groups to stay as they are, as redemptive communities. Also symbolically, there seems to be a change going on with the notion of American folk groups. The shifting from the notion of American folk groups from mountain people, Appalachian Ozarks, as America's ancestors to, ironically, the Amish. In surveys of tourists who go to Northeast Ohio and to Lancaster County, there's this notion of wanting to see the way Americans used to live. Never mind that the Amish have lived in a different kind of American cultural trajectory. This is what people are saying they're coming there. Maybe that has to do also with the notion of tradition taking on a symbolic role to moderns. However, the Hasidim do not fit this pattern of American ancestors. And that's where there seems to be more conflict, particularly racial conflict, that seems to be emerging with the Hasidim as they come to grips again with being urban villagers and not the subject of tourists or of modern interest. And perhaps on the largest level, in conclusion to end this conversation or to start a conversation with you, it's also the idea of faith, which seems to be suspect as a bond of tradition, that somehow tradition should be geographically based of an isolated group or perhaps might be occupationally based. But with the persistence and, in fact, growth of these groups and surveys coming out that are showing religious affiliation in decline in America, and yet you see these, whether you call them extraordinary or sectarian or even ethnic groups, there's this notion that they represent a kind of groupness that is emulable. Although part of the difficulty, at least in modern culture, is that it can't be imitated. It can only be consumed. With that hopefully spurring your thought, I will conclude and I welcome your comments.
Thank you very much, Dr. Brumner. That was absolutely fascinating. My question, maybe you could give us some reflection more specifically on how these enclaves interact with dominant society. Maybe just sort of flesh that out a little bit more. I've spent about a decade of my life within broader Mennonite sort of communities, and I also have spent a decade and a half of my life in the Middle East. So in Yudat et ha-chassidim shegaru liyad ha-mei ha-sharim and so on. So I'm familiar somewhat with both of these enclaves. And for me, a lot of it reflects a sort of politic of difference. And what are the sort of positive portions of that difference that can inform the broader community, and what have been actually sort of inward looking and therefore sort of dysfunctional in some way? What I mean by that is I'm thinking of Robert Merton's theory about dominant culture and how enclaves relate to those dominant narratives, and sometimes the withdrawal is good. And my observation is that insofar as the boundary-keeping functions maintain identity and allegiance within group, it also doesn't allow enclave members to speak to dominant structures. And as I've been a part of certainly this academic community here, I keep thinking in my mind, what is it about our peculiarity, or about our separateness, that hasn't, in the Quaker tradition, allowed us to speak truth to power? So how is our enclativity actually not always using the benefits. You talked about Du Bois, of the benefits of that hybridity, that double consciousness, what Walter Mignolo talks about, the exteriority or border thinking. How can the benefits and the values of these types of enclaves inform broader society? Because they seem to be so caught up within their identity and allegiance groups, I would love to have them inform and speak to so many of our, you know, the anomie, as Durkheim would say, and the chaos, the psychic homelessness of modern society. How can we actually help that interface happen?
Your question has several parts, and I could imagine expanding on them all night here, but let me at least pick on two of, I think, your key points. One is, given that both the Amish and the Hasidim are in the world, but not of it, which is something that they will say all the time. If that is a kind of liminal statement, how do they negotiate it? Because it means constantly of questioning being separate or having a separate identity in which their values and customs can be preserved. You heard that rhetoric being used in the interview. And at the same time, wanting to have an economic and even a political way of connecting to the group, to the larger dominant group, so as to serve their needs. The second part, which I just want to address quickly, is what we can do toward that, which is perhaps even more complicated. What I will say, at least economically, is my experience is in Lancaster and Upper Dauphin County, and I see Holly here too, and she was at the Lancaster Mennonite Historical Society, and you can also give an historical perspective on this as well, in that there was a time, historically, when the Amish didn't want any part of the tourism that was occurring. And that seems to have shifted to embracing the economic opportunities on the justification that this helps preserve their lifestyle. But politically, what they want is to be able to channel the outsiders or the English into these economic zones away from their homes. So if those are familiar, if you are to travel down this Route 30, which tourists hate because it crawls along after going on these major highways, some of that has been as a result of the agency of the Amish. In fact, there was this big controversy over bypassing Amish farmlands for this increased traffic. And the Amish actually fought against it because they wanted this channeling. It is definitely hesitant in how they respond in the halls of power. But I will tell you that one compromise, so to speak, while the Amish are not going to put up candidates for state representatives, they are represented on local zoning boards. That's where they're yielding power, and perhaps capitalism and economics is getting in the way of their egalitarianism, but it's certainly coming through. And there was also a fight about licensing of midwives that was very controversial, in which they also exerted a great deal of influence. Among the Hasidim, a lot of the issues about education, because public education is a problem because of their views of keeping men, or I should say girls and boys, separate with different kinds of education. And they can't do that in public education, so they have private education that's expensive to fund. One of the ways they've tried to do that is to create school districts that will have only Hasidim, which is a real test, after all, of our public school system and the separation of church and state. And this also gets to Wisconsin v. Yoder, a classic case. So education, economics seem to be the forms, if you will, in which some of this is played out. How do we deal with it? I will tell you that both the Amish and the Hasidim are dealing with it by trying to find new settlements and actually sending scouts, a little like the frontier, to find good places to locate and establish new communities. But this also means, again, dealing with social change, because this means upsetting long genealogies and moving and so forth. What can scholars do? This has been difficult because with other kinds of tradition-centered groups like the Cajuns or Appalachians, there's been this notion of scholars applying their work to create workshop to exhibit these groups, to show their artistry and expressiveness as befitting a civilization. Both the Amish and the Hasidim are hesitant to do that, even though they have these great expressive arts. As many of you know, the area of artistry, especially among the Amish, has been in quilt culture, but that has generally not been generated by the Amish themselves. Another place, however, that I find interesting as a bibliophile myself is in book culture, because both readily embrace books. One of the great events in central Pennsylvania is the Lancaster Mennonite Book Sale that brings people from all over. And I remember Abner Byler creating a row within the community in Lancaster County because he wanted to create a library of Amish history. And this created all kinds of talk. You think this is very basic. A lot of ethnic groups have historical society. Why shouldn't the Amish? Because Lancaster Mennonite is probably the place for that. But he's saying, no, we need to take control of that. And he was able to get a building, although it is a little strange to those of you who have ever done research there, because you walk in and you're given a flashlight. So they are trying to maintain their values while saying, this is still research, but it is not academic, as in higher education. Well, this is better than the first time I visited when I was given a kerosene lamp. And working around these books and dust, I was getting a little nervous. But he realized, okay, the compromise is we'll give them flashlights to work around this area. And this book culture fits into scholars as a meeting place because of the promotion of the preservation of texts of important documents, and especially in the area of genealogy, for both groups, I think, of wanting to trace this, and scholars helping them do that, and it is also an avenue toward preservation. I don't know, Holly, since I drew you out, whether from your personal experience, Lancaster Mennonite, you saw some of this as well, of Amish coming in wanting to do genealogical work and share in book culture.
My time there was too brief. I didn't have the chance to observe that.
I have a question about gender.
Yeah.
Among, as you point out, there is this enormous gradation of types, certainly among the Mennonites and the Amish, all the way from the most conservative to the most liberal. But it's been my observation that as groups modernize, especially Mennonites in this case, that the women bear the marks of difference, whereas the men are the first to look modern. I spent last year living in Brooklyn, and of course saw many Hasidim and probably many Orthodox too that I couldn't necessarily distinguish among.
Right.
But one of the things I observed was the way in which the young boys really bear the mark of difference, even more than the young girls, it seemed to me. And that interested me, and I wonder if you have any comment on it.
Sure. First of all, on your notion about women being responsible or taking the function of maintaining tradition, that is certainly a matter for more ethnography, but that pattern seems to be holding. This book that I mentioned about the Old Order River Brethren, which is a small group in Lancaster and in Franklin County, Pennsylvania, made that very point, that she was surprised that the women became more conservative, the men did not. And this is a group that will have washing machines and microwaves and so forth, but the women wanted to emphasize plain dress more so than their parents, partly because of what they feared as a decline in identity as they embraced some of these appliances. And a recent dissertation, which will be a book of a student, also looked at a Hasidic synagogue in Lancaster County that made the same point, particularly in hair covering. That's not my stomach. I don't know if that's my signal to end. So on that point, absolutely. But there are also some boundaries as well that are being created, especially with the concern of resisting the unisex movement. And your question is, again, raising a whole research trajectory that I can't say I've done, although I have a great interest in youth culture. But part of the answer that I would give you for the emphasis on youth culture is that this is partly a response, especially I can say with the Hasidim, because they will vocalize this, that whereas they are willing to embrace certain aspects of modern culture, particularly in technology, they are afraid of a world in which men are the same as women. That they not only see this as not part of God's plan, but also they see this as dangerous. And frankly, they are afraid of the influence of homosexuality. Now, at the same time, there are some disturbing trends as well, in that both groups, because of tensions for women to take on more of a role, there has been more reporting of domestic abuse in both Amish and Hasidic households. And this is raising a lot of investigation, whether that was always there or whether it's just coming out now. And I can't say that I'm expert. I'm following this rhetoric and these investigations that are occurring. But the reason why I bring this up is that in child rearing, there is no Dr. Spock's or baby guy or what to expect when you're 2 years old, which my wife read religiously, nothing like that. It is based upon traditional forms of child rearing, and especially involving grandparents, which a lot of general child rearing, which is nuclear family based, is not. But I could be wrong, but my thesis would be, and especially I lived in Brooklyn, I was part of a group called Aguda Yisrael, which was a ultra-Orthodox group, and a lot of the concern for childhood was not only attention to prayer and to faith and to a reverence for custom and tradition, but a lot of it was to note that gender difference is at the basis of the social structure. If that falls away, they worry, or they will preach, there's not much left. And I will say that this seems to be true among the Amish as well as among the Hasidim, which makes me again think that I could add a bulleted point to my PowerPoint about why this arose and why it is becoming a point of emphasis and being projected onto youth culture.
Thank you very much for this wonderful conversation. And I am a student here of theology and philosophy. My name is Jose Martínez Castro, and I thank you. So you spoke of youth culture to some extent, and the ways in which modern entertainment, if I read you right, desires to consume the what they see as the symbol of tradition by in Amish.
Not replicated.
Correct.
To consume it as
yes.
Kind of symbolism.
Yes. Correct. And I also have noted that there is certain sectors, might call countercultural sectors within modern youth culture, who in fact want to imitate the Amish and Hasidic traditions through movements that are now called Neo-Anabaptist and Neo-Amish quite explicitly, especially on the basis of a growing interest in communitarianism and agrarianism, and even seeing it played out in cities. So I wonder if there's something that you'd like to comment on that, if it is of interest at this time.
I'm not as familiar with Neo-Amish or Neo-Hasidic. They're movements per se, but there have been more attempts to give youth that kind of experience, but allow them to return to their modern life. So, for example, for the Hasidim, there's something called Jugendruf, which means young meat, youth meat. And the idea is that for 2 weeks, they will speak nothing but Yiddish and try to replicate the shtetl life of the past. And there's something like that as well, that people can have an experience on an Amish farm for a couple weeks and experience waking up at 5 a.m., milking the cows, and so forth. It may seem a little strange that this is fun, but it's supposed to be because it allows them to get out of their modern lifestyle. And what's the repercussions of those kinds of camp experiences, or you could say living history, so to speak? I mean, one is that they're treating the Amish as anachronisms. And with the Hasidim, it's not that they're actually living a Hasidic life because they're not in the Hasidic neighborhood, but they're going somewhere to find a connection to their past. Now, and I know the time is getting short, I want to make just one shift over, because that in itself is fascinating from the point of view, and maybe it's a modern point of view, that you can step in and out of modernity, and that you are consuming experience, not just objects. And if you consume the experience, it somehow makes it more real than if I buy a klezmer record or I buy a record of Amish choir singing. But the other thing that's happening that is a way to expand beyond this kind of sociological and cultural inquiry is what's happening in high schools. Because it's hard to avoid movies in which there's not some reference to cliques. And that in itself is not new, and may seem like a whole distance away from what I've been describing, except that some of the formation of communities in high schools, far less than in colleges, is about, yes, belonging and finding yourself and personality, except some of the groups that are being studied, and I welcome those who are teaching sociology to see if this is being covered here, and I'm potentially going to edit an encyclopedia of youth culture, so I recently went through a headlist to try to document some of these groups like Straight Edge and Goths there's a skateboarding subculture and so forth. And what does seem to be new is their proliferation, and that their question is not just about turf or in the usual notion of gangs, but this idea that they want to relate to each other as community. And even uniformity, most of them fail, and yet it seems to be constantly replicated, at least in our time. And I would say this is an area also where ethnography, and I hope American studies comes into play. I don't have all the answers on these groups, but there is definitely a movement. When they get into the news is when they go violent or when they go bad, and accusations of brainwashing and kidnapping and so forth. But there are other examples, more ethnographic, in which they are finding community, and this is somehow fulfilling, whether it's a break from their parents or rediscovering what their grandparents went through is an open question. Among the Hasidim, there's something they're actually concerned about called the Chavura movement, which is the idea that a group decides among itself how it is going to worship or what kind of customs it's going to take on. They do not want to be affiliated, but nonetheless, they want to be a community of practice, that reference that I made there. So thank you for your attention. I hope I didn't keep you too long. I hope there are some ideas here that you can mull over. I welcome more conversations during reception, or if you like my card and want to continue the conversation in email, I'd be glad to give them to you and continue. Thank you.